everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week we're standing firm in the face of adversity. Judy Lee takes us on the run with three generations of women in the age of misadventure.
We all think we're quite happy and that life is fine, but sometimes we need to step outside of it and, you know, see what opportunity life has.
Marcus Berkman suggests confronting a midlife crisis in a shed of one's own.
Different birthdays hit people in different ways. I remember 30 was appalling, and 40 was completely trivial. Didn't mind that at all. And then 50 hit me like a ton of bricks.
And former Marine Simon Marnie gives us a field guide to combating negative attitudes to sight loss.
I didn't know what on earth to expect. So this book is very much about giving a heads up to people who are just starting the process of losing their sight.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Judy Lee spent 20 years teaching drama before taking the decision to pursue her dream of becoming an author. Her first novel, A Grand Old Time, was snapped up by HarperCollins and published last year. Her second, The Age of Misadventure, has just been simultaneously published in print and audio and is also available from the RNIB library. Judy Lee, welcome to Read On.
Hello.
I've just spent a very pleasurable weekend listening to The Age of Misadventure, and I got the real sense that you thoroughly enjoyed writing this book.
Yes, I did. I always enjoy it. I think you have to enjoy everything you do to the most that you can.
And that's certainly the message of the book. It's three generations of women celebrating their independence.
Yes, it's about optimism, really. I think often when I'm writing something, characters begin almost stuck in situations, as many of us are, that release negativity. You know, we all think we're quite happy and that life is fine, but sometimes we need to step outside of it and, you know, see what opportunity life has. And in terms of The Age of Misadventure, it's only when the characters are threatened and in danger that they really appreciate what they have.
Well, yes, they go on the run, and it's very reminiscent of those wonderful 1950s caper movies, isn't it?
Right, okay, I'll take your word for it, Red.
But actually, they discover that they can make their own decisions.
Yes.
And they make good decisions and enjoy being a team.
I'm interested in the three generations of the women, because everyone in the book is at a particular stage where they think they're there, but something can come next. Even in the case of the oldest lady, Nanny, who's in her 80s, who's in a place where sort of somebody's trying to live by themselves and manage from day to day, and they've lost kind of excitement and the joy of life, and yet it's out there for her, and she comes into her own when she finds it.
Oh, she really does, isn't she? From being rather critical of everything that's being done for her, she really does embrace life and finds a second adolescence, I think.
Well, I have my dad to thank for that, because he was in the similar situation, that he wasn't independent, and a lot of Nan's disgruntled words at the beginning of the book are his too. Being by yourself and having meals for one and not being able to put the heating up in the house and watching TV for company is not the most exciting way you can live your life. And of course, when Nan gets out and starts, you know, having trips to London and going out to swanky restaurants, she really realises that she can do things that she didn't think possible.
And it's a wonderfully positive message, as you say. I was wondering, the sense of character comes through very, very strongly, and I think I had sort of visions of a slightly older Julie Walters being
Nan. Oh, that's a lovely thing to say. Thank you so much.
Do you write with, and obviously the influence of your dad, but a vision of who that person is when you're writing the character?
Yeah, very much so. I kind of try to be flexible and leave it open, because sometimes a character will actually shout back at you, particularly late in the night or in the morning. You can kind of wake up and your brain has rested, and they're there at the end of the bed going, actually, I want to go and do this, or why don't you let me go and do that? But I think the interesting thing is to try and write visually, to kind of evoke settings for people, to sort of promote pictures, so that you still leave the reader license to make their own choices and see what they would like to see in their imagination, because all readers are different. But for me, I kind of want to go some way to creating something that's pictorial, almost like a film. So it's nice that you can see Julie Walters going on a joint, because that's exactly what I wanted.
And you spent 2 decades working as a drama teacher.
I did, yes.
Do you think that that experience has fed into your ability to be able to manage a scene?
Without doubt, for several reasons. One is because being on stage is about entertaining. And one thing I really want to be able to do in the books, and if I can get somewhere towards doing it, I'm really happy, is to make people who read it laugh or cry or feel something. I think emotion is quite important for me when I'm writing something, that a character will mean something, that it's like the reader will have a relationship with the character and kind of root for them. So that's quite important. And also, while I was teaching, I had to script a lot anyway. You know, a student will come up and say, I want to do this character, what would they say? And we'd contrive monologues and things. So yes, I loved doing it. I loved putting on plays and directing students. It's only a step away from directing people on a page towards an entertainment and a conclusion at the end of the novel.
And after you stopped working as a drama teacher, you went and did an MA in creative writing?
It's called professional writing. And what happened is that I got to the stage in my life, like a lot of characters do in my books, you get to a stage where you think, do I actually now want to do something else? And the stage was that both of my children had left home. They'd gone to university. And as much as we miss our children, it kind of is our time at that point to take another look at ourselves and what we want to do. And I surprised quite a lot of people when I left. I didn't surprise myself, because I'd been thinking about doing it. And the professional writing MA was not teaching you how to write so much as teaching you how to expect to progress in the profession if you want to, and what the chances were to do so, what the opportunities were, and to kind of flex that muscle a little bit in understanding how to present yourself as a writer and how to pitch a novel, that kind of thing. And it was really good, really great opportunity.
What was the single most useful lesson that you took from that course?
Lots of people would ask me this, and I think the thing I would say to most people is it's to do with resilience and to do with flexibility, which are kind of quite close together. Because we were told stories of, you send your work to an agent and they may not reply at all, or they may reply, thank you, but no thank you. And we have to be resilient and almost paper our walls with rejection. So that rejection doesn't mean you're not good. It means that somebody at that particular point didn't want what you were doing. And it's the same about everything in life, about jobs, about love, about all sorts of things. Rejection doesn't mean that you aren't particularly worthy. It's just a mismatch. And in the same way, flexibility means that you have to be flexible enough to take a step away and go, okay, this isn't for me, but I can still come back and do something else. I mean, I was really lucky that I got an agent really quickly, and she's the most fantastic person I could have asked for. And my publishers are the same, a better team I couldn't wish for. But I think that idea of being resilient in our life, we will have people who won't always give us what we want. Why should they? And we have to be resilient and flexible enough to be able to deal with it.
And that's very much a message that your characters, I think especially Georgie, your 55-year-old
yes.
divorced protagonist who's living on her wits. And
yes.
Gosh, she has a lot of wit. But she's had a lot of hard knocks.
I lived in Liverpool for 10 years. And it's the most wonderful city, because it takes you to its heart and you take it to your heart. And I met an awful lot of strong people, but in the case of Georgie, strong women, who, whatever adverse situations they had, whether it was poverty, whether it was difficulty, whether it was things which happened on their doorstep and made their life tough, they had to come back. And often the people of Liverpool do so with a smile on their face and with a joke and with humour. Myself, I was burgled. I had a house I lived in set on fire. And it becomes something that you can write a story or tell a joke about. And it is such a wonderful city. And they are really such wonderful people. I learned so much from my time there.
Yes, and that thing of curating your own story. This might be something terrible that's happened, but I can turn sour grapes into fine wine.
Absolutely. That's a perfect way of putting it.
Now, there's a lovely quote on your website talking about collaboration with other writers. And
yeah.
I think that's one of the things that maybe outsiders think writers are just locked away in their garrets writing mm-hmm. their own stories. You clearly love collaborating with other people.
Yes.
And the quote of, "Life is a journey, I'm always travelling, and there's always a spare passenger seat."
It is absolutely correct to say that life is a journey. And yes, we're always travelling. And in terms of there being one passenger seat, there may even be more. There's no reason why we shouldn't put a nice trailer on the back and take lots of people with us, because collaboration is where ideas come from. And I don't mean sort of in terms of stealing ideas. I mean in terms of bouncing ideas. At the moment, I've got a lovely friend who's an actor, and she's writing a soap opera. And we had an hour's chat over the phone the other night about how she could make her soap opera better. And between the pair of us, new ideas came out. And that is such a lovely, fulfilling experience.
Yes, pooling one's creativity. And I understand that you have already completed a third novel and have ideas for your fourth and fifth.
Yes, it's like having some sort of bolting horse in the house. I'm rushing around all the time with new ideas. I've just finished a novel about life in a Somerset village, not unrelated to the Somerset village down the road from me. And it's about two sisters, two ladies in their 70s, who've not really been close. And when one of them becomes poorly, she goes to stay with the other one in this sleepy little village that isn't as sleepy as you'd think. And they realise each other's potential when a particularly crazy stranger arrives to be the catalyst for what happens next. So yeah, I've just finished that one. I've started a new one about five women in their 70s. Who embark on a crazy adventure to a city of romance. And I'm about 6,000 words into that one, so who knows where that will go.
And do you know where you might go in researching it?
Well, the first one I wrote, A Grand Old Time, which was about one of the loveliest characters, Evie Gallagher, who takes the journey in a little motorhome from one end of France to the other. I've got an idea for another story with her in it, and it won't be France where she'll be journeying. It'll be somewhere a lot further away for quite specific reasons. And that's a journey I actually want to do, and I don't feel I can write that until I've gone and done it myself.
Well, that sounds like just the kind of challenge we should all have in our lives.
Oh, I'm so lucky, Red, to be able to do this job. I count my blessings every day. Not that I didn't adore teaching, because I did, but I think it's the autonomy of being able to get up in the morning and start when I want to do it. And I am quite driven, so I don't spend all my time waltzing around the garden. But I can stop and have a lovely chat with somebody on the radio. And it's not like the treadmill of it was never a 9-to-5 job. It was more like a sort of 7-to-10 job, really. But that treadmill isn't there anymore. And I'm so blessed to be able to do what I'm doing now.
You have a great ear for dialogue, which really comes out in the audiobook versions.
I have to say, my agent has a background in audiobooks. She's really very good at it and has done it for years and years and years. And when we're talking through a book, she will always say to me, just think about what a character sounds like. There was one particular character I was writing, and she said, "What generation Nigerian are they?" And I said, "Oh, first." And she said, "Okay, because that affects the accent." And I said, "Of course it does. You're so right." And the magic of the performers, these people do an audiobook in one take, which just amazes me. And Aoife McMahon, who did A Grand Old Time, and Julie Maisie, who does The Age of Misadventure, the skills they have to convey the emotions and to make the characters complex is just incredible. They let readers think for themselves while conveying the meaning of the characters and the action through their own voices. And I just think that's such an incredible skill to have.
Are you a big fan of audiobooks yourself?
I love them. I don't spend a lot of time doing audiobooks unless I'm in the gym. And for me, that's the perfect place, because you can whack your earpiece in and you can get on your bike or your running machine. And it's amazing how quickly an hour will go when you're rooted in a good story.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always a good excuse just to spend that little extra time on the exercise bike or whatever, isn't it?
Well, I do it every day. It's part of what I do, because writing means you're sitting down all the time and you can't afford to spend your entire life sitting down. So I try and make sure I have an hour in the gym every day. And as I said before, I'm so lucky to have that flexibility. It's brilliant.
And you must be delighted that you're reaching a wider audience of people who might be otherwise disabled from being able to read print.
Well, that's really important. The idea of being able to picture a book and the characters in your own mind is really, really important. And I know myself, because I'm fairly short-sighted, that not being able to read print when I want to read it is very frustrating. My mum used to go and buy the big print books, and as she got older, she needed that in order to be able to access the stories. And to be able to bring a story alive in every form is really important.
Absolutely. And well, thank goodness that more and more books are being simultaneously published in audio and print.
It's brilliant. What a joy. How brilliant.
Well, I wish you all the very best with books 4 and 5 and hope that we can welcome you back onto the show in the not too distant future.
It would be a pleasure. It would be an absolute joy to talk to you again.
Judy Lee, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Red. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Both A Grand Old Time and The Age of Misadventure are available as talking books from the RNIB library. And Judy Lee will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine in 35 years I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. From Russia with Love, A James Bond Adventure by Ian Fleming. Yubiyanomat! The gross obscenity was a favourite with General G. His hands slapped down on the desk. Comrade, there certainly is a man called Bond, as you put it. His voice was sarcastic. Shems Bond. And nobody, myself included, could think of this spy's name. We are indeed forgetful. No wonder the intelligence apparatus is under criticism. General Vozdvizhensky felt he should defend himself and his department. There are countless enemies of the Soviet Union, Comrade General, he protested. If I want their names, I send to the Central Index for them. Certainly I know the name of this Bond. He has been a great trouble to us at different times, but today my mind is full of other names, names of people who are causing us trouble today, this week. I am interested in football, but I cannot remember the name of every foreigner who has scored the goal against the Dynamos. You are pleased to joke, comrade, said General G, to underline this out-of-place comment. This is a serious matter. I, for one, admit my fault in not remembering the name of this notorious agent. Comrade Colonel Nikitin will no doubt refresh our memories further, but I recall that this Bond has at least twice frustrated the operation of Smersh. That is, he added, before I assumed control of the department. As I say, I've been doing this for 35 years now, and I just hope it carries on forever. Even when my teeth have fallen out and I'm totally gaga, even then I'll have to be dragged kicking and screaming from the studios. I've loved doing it, particularly because we've had some wonderful responses. We all get them. One woman got in touch once, and she was quite late to talking books. But even then, a whole new world had opened up for her. And it's just so exciting to hear that, and makes it all worthwhile. Roberts asked if he could finally add a line to end this, written by him, but I'm going to say it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, Simon Marnie finds light at the end of the tunnel in his Descent into Darkness. But first, last week, Marcus Berkman appeared on the show
celebrating 50 years of Star Trek with his book Set Phasers to Stun. And it seems his own 50th birthday was equally inspiring, as Robert Kirkwood discovered.
A Shed of One's Own, Midlife Without the Crisis by Marcus Berkman. And Marcus joins me from our Camden studio. How are you today?
I'm very well indeed, thank you, Robert.
Now, A Shed of One's Own, can you explain it to us?
It's really a book about being middle-aged. What happened to me was that different birthdays hit people in different ways. I remember 30 was appalling, and 40 was completely trivial. Didn't mind that at all. And then 50 hit me like a ton of bricks. And people said to me, you know, you can have a party, or yeah, you can maybe go on holiday or something. And I said, no. And what I actually did was I basically hid under a duvet for 6 weeks and waited for it to go away. And of course, after 6 weeks, you come back, you come out of the duvet and you're still 50. And this really came from that. I just had a sort of, I'm not a particularly I'm not a depressive person, I'm quite a cheerful person, but I had a real depressive interlude of a few weeks, simply because I've reached this, you know, rather, well, essentially random and trivial birthday. What's a number? It means nothing. And so I thought, well, being a writer always looking for things to write about, this struck me as very interesting. Why get so upset about it? You know, midlife, what's the big deal? And so I just started talking to people. I started thinking about it and talking to people, making notes and coming up with ideas and just watching and listening and seeing how other people respond to suddenly discovering that youth is gone and that, you know, mortality is uppermost in your thoughts.
Did you find the writing of it quite cathartic?
I think that's probably right. Yes, I think I did. I certainly found it useful, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really helpful to really just to think quite deeply about all of this. And of course, I mean, I'm basically a humorous writer, so I'm always looking for the joke. And it is a very funny time of life. Mm. You know, your body starts falling apart in lots incredibly undignified ways. And so there's lots of material about that. And also, you know, suddenly being middle-aged, you remember when you were a child, people who were in their 40s and 50s were treated with great respect and the world was theirs in some way that we couldn't quite understand. And now we reach that age ourselves and the world isn't ours and we're not treated with quite the same respect. And now it's youth is everything and we're sort of in some way past it. And so that was a part of it as well, the sense that we've somehow missed out in some important way and that it's not really our fault. So it was cathartic because, yes, I needed to come up with some way of dealing with it and you know, that's, well, writing it is as good as any.
And we won't find any sports cars or Harley Davidsons in there?
Well, I mentioned them briefly, if only because you have to and because they are the sort of the cliches that, and I know people who have bought sort of comedy sports cars, and I do know one or two people who bought comedy motorbikes. The other one is marathon running. That's a big I've noticed a few men do that, lots of marathon running. And then of course there's all the sort of, well, it's the three M's. It's motorbikes, marathons and mistresses. They're the three M's of middle age.
I've noticed an awful lot of cyclists in middle age wearing clothes that perhaps they shouldn't.
Well, that's true. I I've got a very good friend who's become a sort of cycle lunatic and goes out at the weekends, and his family don't know where he is, but they know wherever he is, he's in Lycra. And and he's probably going up some fantastically steep hill that would be best taken, you know, in a bus or in a car or possibly in a Stana stairlift. But, you know, he's bicycling, his little legs going on, and he's totally obsessed. And he cycles God knows how many miles a week. And he's developed the cyclist's body, you know, incredibly long and thin, and has that sort of haunted look in his eyes. it is a very funny time of life.
Now, I've read a review on Amazon, actually. It says, A Shed of One's Own is the antidote to Jeremy Clarkson, The Daily Mail and Grumpy Old Men. Is that fair?
Well, I think I was quite pleased with that, because it seemed to me that when I started thinking about this, I thought that well, we do have the grumpy old men thing, and people have compared this to that. But I thought grumpy old men was mainly about externals, if you like. You know, it's about, you know, aren't mobile phones irritating? And it's about stuff. It's not actually really necessarily about how you're feeling and how you're experiencing things. A little bit, but not very much. It's much more about the easy and not the obvious joke. And I'd also read a couple of books, people writing about middle age, and they were writing about their own feelings, just about me, you know, me, my life is horrible. Well, you know, we don't care, do we? I didn't want to write just about me. And I wanted to be, but I wanted to be a little more sort of personal, a little more interesting, and delve a bit deeper than the grumpy old men thing. So it's really about, it's not about me, it's about us. That's what the intention of the book is. It's inclusive, I hope. With grumpy old men made all the obvious jokes, so you've got, you, if you're going to make jokes, they have to be better. I hope they are. I worked hard enough at them, but I hope I've said enough that's not been said before, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Now, you mentioned that it's inclusive. Is it inclusive to people who don't own sheds?
Very much so. The title is slightly misleading. I was delighted I've had at least a couple of reviews on the internet, which, of course, everyone says, oh, I never read my reviews. Of course, I read everything. there are a couple reviews which said, by no means is there enough about sheds in this book. And you sort of think, yes, I mean, there is one chapter in which sheds are talked about. What happened was that the publishers didn't like any of my titles. I kept coming up with titles for the book. That won't sell in you know, in Northern Ireland or something, you know. And this is terrible for the export, blah, blah, blah. I was getting increasingly desperate. And there is a joke in the chapter which talks about sheds. Says, you know, a shed of one's own. The joke on the Virginia Woolf book, A Room of One's Own. Mm. So I just suggested that in desperation. And they said, brilliant, that's the title. And so, okay, off you go. And now everyone says, so is this a book about sheds? No, it's not really. The idea really was that, yes, we do need a shed. We need something like it. And we don't necessarily need to have a shed that is a shed. It can be a sort of spiritual shed or a sort of metaphorical shed. It's what I call it, the internal shed, which is the space where you can just completely switch off and think your thoughts and not really be bothered by the rest of the world. I wrote a bit about men fishing. And I have a friend who goes fishing, and he just stands there for long periods, and he's not doing anything. And he looks as though he's thinking serious and deep thoughts, but he's not thinking anything. And you go up to him and prod him to see if he's still alive. And then after about 2 hours, he takes out a sandwich and he eats it so slowly. And if you said to him, Patrick, what's in that sandwich? And he'd look at you and he'd have to think for about a minute before, you know. And that's the internal shed. He's happy. He's still. And he's found the room of his own, but it happens to be on a riverbank. And that's what I was trying to say, is that really everyone needs somewhere that they can go just to do nothing and switch off. One of the chapters is called Leisure, and this is about this is really an A to Z of ludicrous things that middle-aged men end up doing. Things that our younger selves would have laughed at, and it's done in an alphabet, A to Z. B is for balsa wood. In the film The King's Speech, there's a scene in which speech therapist Geoffrey Rush invites Colin Firth as George VI to glue a couple of bits onto an unfinished model aircraft his son has left lying around. Firthy's eyes light up. So do the eyes of all the middle-aged men in the audience. Within seconds, they are sobbing for their own lost childhoods, when they used to make things out of balsa wood and poorly painted Airfix models dangled from their bedroom ceilings, ready to drop on someone's head at any moment. In fact, there is hardly any better illustration of what psychiatrists call flow than model making or putting ships in bottles or whatever mad, pointless activity it was that you did as a child. Hours would vanish as you carefully attached some strut or stanchion to the wrong bit of the wing. The incorrect application of a decal could ruin everything, and even if you were good at it, you'd be smelling of glue for weeks. If children smell of glue these days, the social services are called. You grew out of model making, as everyone does. Maybe it's now time to grow back into it.
There's no point to it. But then that's one of the blissful discoveries of middle age. Pointlessness is its own reward. A man must have a shed to keep him sane.
A Shed of One's Own by Marcus Berkman is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. The print version is available in any good bookshop, and there's also an accessible Kindle version available now.
Thanks to Marcus Berkman and to Robert Kirkwood. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up before the end of the show, Judy Lee returns with the books of her life. But first, when Simon Marnie retired, he moved to Derbyshire, planning to improve his landscape painting. Instead, he began a three-year battle with glaucoma that eventually cost him his sight. But the former Royal Marine was not to be defeated. The result is A Descent into Darkness, a book designed to help others in a similar situation. He joined me down the line and began by telling me his reasons for writing the book.
Well, the book basically is a recounting of my experience of losing my sight over 4 or 5 years to the point of total blindness. And one of the things that I think, use the word outraged, is a fair one, that outraged me was that from the very beginning, the whole experience was made far worse because nobody told me anything. I didn't know what on earth to expect. So this book is very much about giving a heads up to people who are just starting the process of losing their sight, trying to tell them or give them some idea of what to expect, and point out that actually, while it's quite alarming, it's not that harmful, and you can cope with it, providing you know it's coming.
Yeah, it's a manual, but equally you are very clear that it's not one-size-fits-all sight loss. It's just being mentally prepared.
Absolutely, yeah. I think those of us who are in the service are very lucky because we were taught at a very impressionable age to have a certain attitude to life. You know, the old commando thing about cheerfulness in the face of adversity. And I think that actually did sustain me a lot. Being put in touch with blind veterans also sustained me because you walk into a room full of ex-squaddies all taking a mickey because none of them can see. You just can't remain downhearted for very long. And then you meet people who have had the most dreadful injuries in Afghanistan and lost their sight as well. You suddenly begin to realise, actually, all that's wrong with me is I can't see. And it does help you put things in perspective. Because I was going through all these experiences, this book is very much about facing the future by, first of all, accepting that there is a future. Because so often, I think, when you have any kind of disability, handicap, impairment, call it what you like, there seems to be almost a concerted effort to put you in a corner and prevent you having any future of any description. And so many of us actually collude with that. And this book is very much an effort to say to people, actually, it's not that bad. You can cope. There are people around who will help you. And if you just get on with it, you'll be amazed how things work out. Whereas so many of us, I think, are condemned to just sitting in a corner and being left there. I remember very vividly when I was doing an exhibition, one of these sight loss exhibitions for blind veterans, and I was talking to a couple about the benefits that the charity could bring. And the wife turned around and said, I don't think so. I know my husband. I think what she was saying was, look, he's enough trouble just sitting in a corner not getting under my feet. The last thing I want is him actually blundering around and causing problems by trying to do things. So I think there's so many different dynamics going on when you pick up some kind of impairment. And it's what you might call the burden of labelling. Mm. Once you've got a label, people will try and make you fit it, and you're constantly fighting other people's preconception of what a blind person should behave like. In the book, I talk about the fact that whilst we are struggling to escape from the box of disability, others are equally enthusiastically trying to stuff us back in. And I felt that all along, that I do what I do in spite of other people, not necessarily because of them.
Yeah, that tension between wanting to be independent and actually having to be dependent on other people who might not necessarily have your best interests at heart or might be making their own lives easier rather than facilitating yours really comes through for the book. And I think it will really chime with any of us who have lost our sight rather than being born blind. It's the terrible thing where you walk into a room and the first thing that someone does is offer you a seat. It's like, well, actually, I still want to be mobile. I still want to get around the room and talk to other people.
Yeah. Can I put you in a corner somewhere so you can rock with your slippers?
Yeah, well, I'm a rock climber and you're a former Marine commando. It doesn't go with the adventurous spirit, does it?
Not really, no.
The other thing that I really liked about the book and that chimed with me is actually your determination to embrace the fear, to say that actually it's all right to be scared of what's happening to you, but you've got to own it if you're going to go forward with it.
Yeah. I think the hardest part is you've got to own it because you have to accept that there are so many things that we do that help to define us, but the impairment may deny us access to, and we literally have to redefine who we are, either by finding other ways of doing the same thing or by finding something else to do. I was an artist. I know, if you like, my creative outlet is now exercised through writing. I write for a magazine called Health is Your Wealth, and I do little articles for them about issues of, for example, the interface between medical resources and the public and what happens when the two-part company, like nothing at all, until you happen to be lucky enough to be picked up by someone who can point you in the right direction. I don't know whether that sounds a bit cynical, but that's basically what could have happened to me. Fortunately, after fighting to get registered, I was referred to the eye clinic liaison officer, whose first question was, did you serve? And I said, well, yes, but not for very long. I said, doesn't matter. We'll put you on to blind veterans, and the rest, they say, is history. I mean, thank God for blind veterans. I just wish that everybody who has sight loss could have the same level of service. I think, in a way, this book is about sharing what I've learnt through blind veterans and learnt about myself through the support of blind veterans.
And highlighting to people who aren't former servicemen the rights and services that they should be able to receive as blind people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was acting as a beneficiary recruitment advisor, I leave you to put the initials together and have a little chuckle for blind veterans. I used to do lots of talks with either nurses or doctors or macular societies or whatever. I used to go around thumping the tub about blindness. And it was amazing. In the support groups like Macular Society, I would talk about registration and say, what's that? Excuse me? You don't know about registration? Oh, my dear chap, have you any idea of the benefits? And I'd reel off the benefits of registration. So not even the basics of getting people registered so at least they're on the map is necessarily being done automatically.
So if you could change one aspect of the journey from being a sighted person to being somebody who's registered blind, what would that be?
I think it would be automatic signposting to organisations that you may need in the future at the earliest possible moment. Once it becomes clear that your sight is going in only one direction, you should be put in contact with the organisations who are geared up with the ability to provide resources, training, information giving and general support.
Now, as a writer, my guess is that you're probably a very keen reader as well.
Oh, yeah.
How do you access your books now?
Well, I access them through Kindle. I've got a Kindle Fire, and the Kindle Fires, and I think it's the only one, unfortunately, actually have a text-to-speech capacity. I just download them from Amazon, and I just take it from there.
And did you belong to the R&IB Talking Books Library?
No, I didn't. I actually put forward the book for the library, but they felt that it wasn't one of the books they were going to select for this month.
Right, but you haven't accessed the library for your own...
No, I haven't, because I don't really need to, because I can get any book I want through Kindle.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter whether it's Patrick O'Brien, Bernard Cornwell, Simon Scarrow, or, as I'm reading at the moment, The History of the English-Speaking Peoples, which is a bit heavy, but very interesting.
Oh, right, OK. And have you got plans to write another book?
Well, I'm writing a book at the moment for my grandchildren, because it suddenly occurred to me that I know a little bit about my grandparents. I know nothing about my great-grandparents. And I'm in a position to actually let my grandchildren know about their grandfather, their great-grandfather, and their great-great-grandfather, with details of things they got up to and little stories from the time which have passed down into family myth. So I'm doing that at the moment to provide a link from the, I suppose, starting in 1873 forward for my grandchildren.
Oh, right, OK. Well, I'm glad to know that you've still got fingers to keyboards and that there'll be another book coming out. For the R&IB Connect radio listeners, how do we access Descent into Darkness?
Well, it's very simple. You either go to Amazon and you key in Simon Marnie, A Descent into Darkness, or you can go to my website, which has got alternative platforms. It's on about five different platforms, and it's also got a direct link to the book on Amazon. And my website is wingingitblind.com.
Well, Simon Marnie, thank you so much for sharing your insights into losing your sight with the Connect Radio listeners. Best of luck in the future, and I'll look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Brett? Is that a guide dog I could hear in the background?
No, that's my guided missile.
Thanks again to Simon Marnie. Have you read a book that helped you through hard times? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you like to return to? Why not tell us about it? Our email address is readonair@rnib.org.uk, and we'd love to hear from you.
RNIB has a first-class idea to help people with sight loss. Don't throw away the stamps from your letters and parcels. Send them to RNIB. Last year, we raised much-needed money by recycling stamps. So, help us raise even more for people living with sight loss. Just collect your stamps and send them to RNIB Stamp Recycling, P.O. Box 185, Benfleet, SS7 9BH. Or visit rnib.org.uk for more information. Help RNIB improve the lives of people with sight loss. And send us your stamps.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
RNIB Talking Books have always had the privilege of working with some great narrators, many of whom have never recorded audiobooks anywhere else. Joyce Grenfell was a star of both the small and big screen, who also found time to author books, record a number of humorous albums, and even appear on The Ed Sullivan Show on American TV alongside Elvis Presley. She became best known for her one-woman shows and monologues, and in 2005, 27 years after her death, she was voted amongst the top 50 in a poll to find the comedian's comedian. Her memoirs and a biography are available in the Talking Books Library, but the one to look out for is Joyce Grenfell Requests the Pleasure Of, that she read for us back in 1972.
I was born in Montpelier Square, London, in 1910. The elder child of Nora and Paul Phipps. The background to my mother is light. All the rooms she lived in were light. Pale rooms with notes of strong colour. Geranium pink, lipstick red, chalk blue, saffron yellow. No top lighting. pools of light from lamps, with wide white shades painted pink inside to her order, pools of light on tables. Low bowls of massed, solid-coloured flowers, geraniums, primroses, gardenias, roses. Uncluttered, lived-in rooms, warm in winter, cool in summer. A wicker basket full of polished apples, and when she could get them, the tiny scarlet and white lady apples from Virginia. Not many pictures on the walls, but always leaves. Branches of beech leaves beginning to unpleat. Laurel, shined with salad oil to prolong its brilliance. Sometimes bare winter branches, all of them standing in large glass tanks or white pottery urns. Wherever she lived, these things appeared, in London, North Carolina, and New York. The times we lived in Canada came too early for me to remember clearly, but I have the same impression of light in Vancouver and Winnipeg before I was aware of detail. Light and warmth, or as she spelt it, W-A-R-M-P-T-H, the added P added a degree or two to the temperature. She has been gone for 22 years, but the qualities that drew people to her still ring in the air like music for those who knew and loved her, and they are many. The patterns she made on the memory are clear, funny, exasperating, lovable. Her weaknesses brought pain, but her essence, and this is what has endured, is light, luminous, and illuminating.
That's Joyce Grenfell reading from our book, Joyce Grenfell Requests the Pleasure Of, back in 1972. For more information on this and other celebrity narrators, head to the Talking Book pages of www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Judy Lee to hear the books of her life. So, Judy, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading?
Yes, I think it's really difficult to pick just one, because I started reading when I was 3 or 4 and just read avidly everything I could get my hands on. I read The Black Tulip when I was 8, which is kind of a boy's book, and there were so many books that I lapped up. But the one that jumps at me most of all as a kind of 13-year-old is Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Charming introduction to a hermit's life. 4 weeks torture, tossing and sickness. Oh, these bleak winds and bitter northern skies and impassable roads and dilatory country surgeons. And oh, this dearth of the human physiognomy. And worse than all, the terrible intimation of Kenneth that I need not expect to be out of doors till spring. Mr. Heathcliff has just honoured me with a call. About 7 days ago, he sent me a brace of grouse, the last of the season. Scoundrel. He is not altogether guiltless in this illness of mine, and that I had a great mind to tell him. But alas, how could I offend a man who was charitable enough to sit at my bedside a good hour and talk on some other subject than pills and draughts, blisters and leeches? This is quite an easy interval. I am too weak to read, yet I feel as if I could enjoy something interesting. Why not have up Mrs. Dean to finish her tale? I can recollect its chief incidents as far as she had gone. Yes, I remember her hero had run off and never been heard of for 3 years, and the heroine was married. I'll ring. She'll be delighted to find me capable of talking cheerfully. Mrs. Dean came. "It wants 20 minutes, sir, to take in the medicine," she commenced. "Away, away with it," I replied. "I desire to have..." "No, the doctor says you must drop the powders." "With all my heart, don't interrupt me. Come and take your seat here. Keep your fingers from that bitter phalanx of vials. Draw your knitting out of your pocket. That will do. Now continue the history of Mr. Heathcliff from where you left off to the present day. Did he finish his education on the continent and come back a gentleman? Or did he get a sizar's place at college, or escape to America and earn honours by drawing blood from his foster country? Or make a fortune more promptly on the English highways? But you may may have done a little in all these vocations, Mr. Lockwood, but I couldn't give my word for any.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, including as TB16036, which is narrated by Michael Kitchen. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, there is. There's a book that I absolutely adore called Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer, who wrote it as a very young author. I think he was in his 20s. And it kind of encapsulates everything that I love in books, because it's a bittersweet comedy and it's a tragic horror as well. The comedy is in the young Ukrainian translator, who is hilarious in his translations. His words are really, really funny. And Jonathan Safran Foer is in it himself. He narrates and he goes back to Ukraine to find out his grandfather's backstory. And as the novel unfolds, it's really tragic what has happened to him. The other thing about this story, which might be really interesting, is that the taxi driver has a guide dog. And the taxi driver is such a hilarious character. It's so beautifully written.
It was March 18th, 1791, when Trackim B's double-axle wagon either did or did not pin him against the bottom of the Broad River. The young W twins were the first to see the curious flotsam rising to the surface. Wandering snakes of white string, a crushed velvet glove with outstretched fingers, barren spools, schmutzy pince-nez, rasp and boysenberries, feces, frillwork, the shards of a shattered atomizer, the bleeding red ink script of a resolution. I will. I will. Hannah wailed. Chana waded into the cold water, pulling up above her knees the yarn ties at the ends of her breeches, sweeping the rising life debris to her sides as she waded farther.
"What are you doing over there?"
the disgraced usurer Yankel D called, kicking up shoreline mud as he hobbled towards the girls. He extended one hand to Chana and held the other, as always, over the incriminating abacus bead he was forced by the Shtetl proclamation to wear on a string around his neck.
"Stay back from the water, you will get hurt!"
The good gefilte fishmonger, Bitzel Bitzel R, watched the commotion from his paddle boat, which was fastened with twine to one of his traps.
"What's going on over there?" he shouted to shore. "Is that you, Yankel? Is there some sort of trouble?"
"It's the well-regarded rabbi's twins," Yankel called back. "They're playing in the water, and I'm afraid someone will get hurt."
Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated is available in Braille and as TB20708, narrated by Tom Stanley. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I have just discovered the writing of Camilla Shamsi, who is just such a clever writer. And I think her books have really opened my eyes to making impactful pictures come to life in a novel. I've just read something called Home Fire by Camilla Shamsi. I think it won an award in 2017. And it's a retelling of Sophocles' Antigone story. It's a contemporary setting. It's about a woman who wants to bring her brother's body back from Iraq. And the twists and turns and the shocking ending are just incredible. It's the most powerful and wonderful book.
Isma was going to miss her flight. The ticket wouldn't be refunded because the airline took no responsibility for passengers who arrived at the airport 3 hours ahead of the departure time and were escorted to an interrogation room. She had expected the interrogation, but not the hours of waiting that would precede it, nor that it would feel so humiliating to have the contents of her suitcase inspected. She'd made sure not to pack anything that would invite comment or questions. No Quran, no family pictures, no books on her areas of academic interest. But even so, the officer took hold of every item of Isma's clothing and ran it between her thumb and fingers, not so much searching for hidden pockets as judging the quality of the material. Finally, she reached for the designer label down jacket Isma had folded over a chair back when she entered, and held it up, one hand pinching each shoulder. "This isn't yours," she said. And Isma was sure she didn't mean, because it's at least a size too large, but rather, it's too nice for someone like you. "I used to work at a dry cleaning shop. The woman who brought this in said she didn't want it when we couldn't get rid of the stain." She pointed to the grease mark on the pocket. "Does the manager know you took it?" "I was the manager." "You were the manager of a dry cleaning shop, and now you're on your way to a PhD program in sociology in Amherst, Massachusetts." "Yes." "And how did that happen?" "My siblings and I were orphaned just after I finished uni. They were 12 years old, twins. I took the first job I could find. Now they've grown up, I can go back to my life." "You're going back to your life in Amherst, Massachusetts?" "I meant the academic life. My former tutor from LSC teaches in Amherst now, at the university there. Her name is Hira Shah. You can call her. I'll be staying with her when I arrive, until I find a place of my own." "In Amherst?" "No, I don't know. Sorry, do you mean her place or the place of my own? She lives in Northampton. That's close to Amherst. I'll look all around the area for whatever suits me best. So it might be Amherst, but it might not. There are some real estate listings on my phone, which you have." She stopped herself. The official was doing that thing which she'd encountered before in security personnel, staying quiet when you answered their question in a straightforward manner, which made you think you had to say more. And the more you said, the more guilty you sounded.
Home Fire by Camilla Shamsi is available in Braille and as TB24141. And it's read by Avita J. Judy Lee, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and for being a guest on Read On.
It has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for asking me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.